Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined today by Ms. Sara Gonsara. How are you?
A bit chilly up here in the far north.
Indeed, we have a lot of rain at the moment. Well, it's not a lot of rain. It's more like a kind of damp blanket over the city. Yeah. And of course, we're also joined by Mr. Michael Morris, who is joining us from Cape Town. Michael, how are things? How is Cape Town?
All good, and actually quite summery today. Actually, it's really probably the warmest day we've had since last summer. So, yeah, so in contrast to your discomfort.
So if you are watching us live, you will notice that we are much earlier than usual. And that is because, of course, today our overlords at ESCOM have decreed that we are going to be having load shedding stage 4. So, to avoid load shedding, we're having to record earlier, which is just great. Michael, I shudder to ask, are you having load shedding in the next 24 hours?
We have stage 1 in Cape Town, and today it's not going to affect me at all. So yeah, I'm glad to say that Cape Town is free of this penalty.
Oh, lucky, lucky, lucky. Anyway.
Let's put it this way. If I were an opposition leader, I would be absolutely chuffed.
Quite.
Yeah,
quite.
Indeed. Yeah. And I theorized with Sara before the show that maybe the reason we're having load shedding stage 4 is because they're doing more maintenance to prevent load shedding on election day itself. But the fact that there is load shedding before the election, when we know in the past that load shedding has been something that has been politically manipulated, I think suggests that things are very bad at ESCOM if they have to load shed just before the election.
Can I just suggest as a precaution that our audience take their own candles to the voting stations on Monday?
It'll look like some sort of vigil or mourning.
Yes, in a way.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, let's actually start with part of the problem, I suspect, which is our first story is to do with ESCOM. And I think it was last week, ESCOM's chief operating officer, Jan Oberholzer, revealed that Coburg Power Station, which is, of course, South Africa's single nuclear power station, is shedding skilled workers at a very rapid rate, according to the chief operating officer of ESCOM. Highly educated technicians are quitting their jobs at Coburg and taking up offers overseas because they can be paid much more there. And basically, Coburg is now suffering because of brain drain. Also, due to the electricity shortage in the country, ESCOM is trying to keep Coburg running for much longer than was originally planned. They want to keep it running for, I think, another 20 to 24 years. I think it was only supposed to run for originally another 10 to 15 years, although I could be wrong about that. And they've submitted an application to this effect to the National Nuclear Regulator, asking for permission, basically, to keep the thing running for another 2 to 2.5 decades. And recently, Coburg has had a lot of problems, which is contributing, no doubt, to our current load shedding. Unit 1 was offline for 5 weeks this year due to a fault in the primary pump breaker. Unit 2 at the reactor remained hadn't had an outage since 350 days ago, but did have one about a year ago. Some steam generators were broken, and they're trying to replace them. So it's all not looking so good for ESCOM. Sara, your thoughts on this? How did it get to that stage that Coburg is scrambling to find skilled workers, and what are they going to do without them?
Look, given the fact that something as specific as a nuclear power station is with regard to the requirement for skills and running the enterprise with the safety levels one would expect, it's an indictment upon an indictment on the ANC government, because if people, first of all, there is just no way that they should not be paying whatever people are paid overseas to run a nuclear facility. They cannot afford to lose skilled workers, and they cannot afford to continue both at Kubert, I assume, probably not, but at anywhere else to employ anyone on the basis of BEE, cadre deployment, or whatever else it may be. It is about merit. These are technological operations, and they have to be managed and run and supported by technologically capable people. It's the bottom line. And this, there's something about the fact that the ANC decided that it could rob the electricity provider and somehow get away with it. Somehow the society would not collapse under the weight of absolutely irregular electricity. Absolutely stymies me. It's a real wake up call for the fact that you have to rely on merit to run anything. And that is not a comment on race or color or creed or anything else. It's simply a matter of the fact that the ANC cannot pick and choose who it wants. The people who run and know how to run these entities must be in a position to choose the people who are capable and prepared to work hard.
So I must say, I've mentioned this before, I'm a really big fan of nuclear power. I think it is a very good energy source, particularly when you invest in it properly. But considering all of the problems at Eskom, considering the massive issues they've had with breakdowns, incompetence, I mean, I believe that at one of the big coal power stations, I can't remember whether it was Modupi or Kusile, one of the new ones, but it had an explosion because the staff didn't follow maintenance procedures correctly. That was a few months ago. And no doubt that's also contributing to our load shedding right now. But I am, Michael, beginning to get a little bit worried about the fact that we have a nuclear power plant where we now know that skilled staff are leaving for overseas. Is this a completely unjustified fear, Michael? What do you make of all of this?
No, I certainly don't think so. And I agree with Sarah entirely. you know, our colleagues have certainly in my case, our clever colleagues have written extensively recently about the benefits of nuclear power, about the issues of getting rid of the waste and so on. There tends to be a lot of emotional misinformation about that or misperception of the issues. Nuclear really is, you know, it's clean, it's efficient, but it has to be properly run, as Sarah indicates. And so it really is a worry, you know, is this an indication that the best possible power option for our future is receding from us because we won't have the people available to run it. I think, you know, I know everyone has to be careful of anecdotal evidence these days, but certainly if I think of people in our street who've had kids who've become very well qualified, gone to university, hundreds of millions of tax rands have been spent on educating young South Africans, the brightest who are able to get to university, and they emerge. And they're not necessarily engineers, but some of them are. And there simply are not career options for them for exactly the reasons that Sarah has explained. And so they go overseas. So we are losing, we're squandering this money on a good cause and then letting the fruit kind of rot, if you like. You know, people simply leave the country because there isn't anything for them here. So it cuts right to the heart of the ANC's proposition, and it's a very costly one.
I like the point you just made about being careful with anecdotes. there's a podcast I listen to where the host says the plural of anecdote is not data.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, I mean it's a good point. You know.
But still, I think in this case, if someone did do the research, they'd probably find the data does in fact. Very closely, and there has been a little bit of research to suggest this anecdote there, which is that, you know, this brain drain is a big problem, and the sort of, I don't know, the mainstream thought is just not willing to countenance a discussion about the effects of CADA deployment of, well, they're starting to get to CADA deployment now. I think this is the first year I've seen the mainstream sort of kind of tentatively talking about CADA deployment as maybe being part of the problem, but they haven't quite gotten to BE yet.
Yeah. And of course, the other issue, which it tends to kind of smother, and also it tends to be misperceived in a way, is that we're not talking only about white graduates or white skinned people who are, you know, finding that there aren't the opportunities, there's not the salary. As Horace says, if we're going to do this seriously, we must actually match global standards in terms of
right.
pay and so on. So it's you know, it's increasingly becoming less of an obviously white issue. It's exactly. just skilled people, you know.
And one of the reasons, I mean, people don't, you know, people of all races don't want to stay in a country where they can get paid more overseas and also don't have to suffer from crime and blackouts.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, I think, let me go to you, Sara. Sara, any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
I think what's terrifying about this is that the fact that it's not as if these issues have happened suddenly. The ANC has had more than enough opportunity to get to grips with the fact that we need the best people possible. It would look good for the ANC because if you produce enough electricity and it's well produced and well maintained, the government gets credit. Nobody looks behind the scenes. And the other thing, of course, is the pure numbers of it. I mean, if they're so, they're very obsessed with the fact that whites, you know, may take positions that they'd rather have blacks take. The problem is that the working age of white South Africans probably numbers about 4% of the population. So in other words, if they're worried about the numbers, there's no way the white population can sort of swamp the positions that the ANC prefer the black population hold. It's proportionately, it's just completely absurd. And in any event, I mean, you know, if people have got the skills of at any level and are trained, they're just fill the positions and they're going to come from everywhere. The fact is that they will not necessarily come from the in terms of the demographics of the population, but then that's an absurd measure anyway. Mm. No successful society in the world has the same number of doctors per proportion of population. Nowhere. I mean, it just doesn't work. People gravitate to things depending on what they choose to, and that's a freedom. I don't know, actually, words.
Course, one of the problems we can't pay people more is because Eskom is in massive debt because of all the mismanagement that's been going on for the last couple of years anyway. So, you know, we've got so few options now to get out of this mess.
Money. I saw a figure this morning that they say that Eskom is going to need another 500 billion.
Oh, yay. Wasn't it a year ago that they said there would be no more bailouts for Eskom? Anyway.
Well, they can say it again because we can't.
Oh, what fun. Anyway, I think everyone gets the point on that. Load shedding is definitely going to be with us for a while yet because the fundamental causes of the malaise and mismanagement at Eskom have not been addressed and are core to the ANC's worldview. And until that changes, we unfortunately are going to sit here with stage 4 load shedding, stage 2 load shedding, or maybe even after the election we'll get to stage 6 or 8. We'll see. Fun times. Anyway. Let's move on to if CADA deployment and BEE are part of the problem. Another part of the problem is, of course, one that we keep coming back to, which is the terrible state of the South African police force. A story has come out relatively recently, and four police members are appearing at the Bellevue Magistrates Court on charges of assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm and common assault. This is after CCTV cameras picked them up trying to basically hit on some girls who were walking down the street, sort of teenage girls. They asked the girls if they wanted to get in their car and go for a ride with them, quite sort of suggestively. The girls allegedly said something along the lines of, yeah, no, we're not going to do that, chief. and the police then assaulted them, according to according to the prosecution here. On the CCTV camera footage, the cops were seen slapping a 17-year-old girl during the incident. And they allegedly also shot one of the girls with a rubber bullet. Now, thank God it wasn't an actual bullet. But she got a nasty wound on her stomach. And this is hence the assault to cause grievous bodily harm charge that they've laid here. So the four officers have appeared in court now. And this is following an investigation by IPED. So I'm glad that they are appearing in court. This is very important. Sarah, what do you make of this?
Well, I think what it illustrates is that our police force is in very, very deep trouble. And it's not to say that these events don't happen. I mean, we've seen the case of Sarah Everard in England being murdered by a police officer. So, you know, you're not going to eliminate bad behavior by the police, but we are looking at policing in an area that is probably amongst the highest crime ridden areas of the country. Mm. Young women in those areas are raped, murdered, beaten with horrible regularity. And what this means is that they lost resort for some safety and some security has shown that it is absolutely of no assistance to the women of the area. But also, of course, this reflects a number of things. It reflects the quality of the training, the quality of the personnel, the fact that you have youngish men in uniform, which can be a bad thing because testosterone levels can make them think they're more powerful than they are. And more than anything, it's a terrible indictment on the quality of the management of the police service. Over the last few years, we've seen the police service managed with appalling poorness. And in a society, in an environment where you need really top flight skills, and I suspect you've got cadre deployment. You haven't got merit. Here we go again. I mean, it's actually a terrifying idea that you cannot rely on the police as your last resort of safety because they are the problem. And so, I think we were just very lucky they were caught on camera.
Yeah, or else maybe this case would have disappeared.
Yeah.
We've seen this, in South Africa we have, because of course we have such high levels of sexual assault, of rape, of things like that, we've seen this kind of, I guess, mostly feminist-led discussion in the public sphere about ending gender-based violence. Now, I think that term is often a bit misused. But what strikes me is that a case like this, where there's sort of actual things, actual problems kind of identified, an actual case, doesn't get that much discussion or coverage. You know, I mean, it was covered in the media, but it didn't turn into some huge national debate. So much of the debate around gender-based violence is this kind of amorphous, vague thing about structural inequalities or patriarchy or something like that. Yeah. Exactly. And we never get to anything approaching a solution apart from sort of catchphrases like teach men not to rape. Well, I mean, yeah, sure, I agree. But, you know, most of the people who perpetrate these acts are not exactly coming from model homes. Michael, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, if you look at those images, you're seeing young men who would appear to feel they have impunity to act as they wished. And that, I think, relates very much to Sarah's point about training and about accountability and management. That if you have young recruits coming into a police service, that kind of stuff needs to be drummed into them. This is how you behave. These are the protocols. You act in this way. If this happens, these are your options. That's what you do. But, you know, here we have this kind of free-for-all, this testosterone-driven behavior, which seemingly, which had nothing whatever to do with law and order and everything to do with, you know, some opportunistic encounter, so it would seem. And then, as you say, you know, on top of that, they released on a warning, contrary to or in contrast to so many other cases where, you know, bail is denied and there's huge hoo-ha about not letting suspects or accused people out on the streets. Here they released on a warning, and then subsequent to that, society doesn't seem to manage to gird its loins to say very much. It's just, you know, it's almost as if it's just accepted. It's just another event, but we will make a huge fuss about, I don't know, taking the knee or Gareth Cliff or whatever it might be. That'll become the cause to drum to beat.
That is completely true, Michael. I mean, you look at the shows this week, and we've had really good, well-watched shows the last 2 weeks because we've been talking about symbols. I don't know why, but there's just something about the modern, the way we do politics in the modern world that we're really obsessed with symbols. I mean, you know, symbols have always been important, but it just seems to be completely overwhelming at the moment.
It's just this past week, I've often thought of one of my mother's favorite expressions, late mother's favorite expressions, that she was fed up to the back teeth. And I'm kind of feeling fed up to the back teeth with all this stuff.
Can I also suggest that symbols take on and gestures take on a disproportionate importance when everything else around you is collapsing?
Yeah, I think that's very true.
Can I just make one little suggestion? You know, from a gender-based violence point of view, you cannot educate men. It's too late. It's not for the police to do the educating. The police are what you get when the deed has happened.
Mm.
The elephant in the room for the society is that it has to deal with male attitudes towards women on a cultural level, and it has to be dealt with boy children probably in the early teens. The experience seems to be that once you get past the age of, say, 15, if a bad attitude towards women has been inculcated, it cannot be changed.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the one area of government that can be involved in this is the education sector.
Yeah.
And, of course, a contributing factor to it is the fact that so many families are growing up without two parents. Which certainly contributes to this. I mean, when boys grow up without a good male role model, they often turn to very, very toxic and destructive behavior. And I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if none of the police officers involved in this grew up in a home with a sort of father figure. Anyway, let us move on to our last story for today. And this is something that I was complaining about on one of our internal WhatsApp groups. And Michael thought it was interesting. So let's kind of dive into it. There was a report on Eyewitness News, which was headlined, "BoCup Residents Still Not Convinced by DA Promises." And it was a sort of normal report just saying that the DA, mayoral candidate Jordan Hill Lewis, was having a rally in the BoCup area around Cape Town, and also the premier Alan Windey was there. But to justify the headline, they interviewed literally one unnamed person who said, "Housing, water, everything is not right. You must be joking if you think I'm going to vote for the DA." It then ends the report by saying that the DA garnered 89% of the vote in that ward in the last local government election, which would make it probably in the top 20 or top 10 safest DA wards in the entire country. And it annoyed me so much because, as far as I'm concerned, the big media houses, particularly Times Live and Eyewitness News, but also to a similar extent, Media 24, have been manifestly unfair to the opposition and particularly to the DA this election campaign. Now, Michael, you often have a much more positive view of the media, but you were also vexed by this report. What concerned you about it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, really exactly the things that you've highlighted. You know, I look at it and I think, well, I appreciate that the process of making news has changed, and maybe there was just the reporter, it went straight to one other person who slapped on the headline and and it went live. And that's certainly very different from the kind of media process or newspaper process that I was accustomed to for most of my career. But that's
right. Can I just interrupt to say Michael has very extensive experience in the media business. Michael, what you were at the start for how many years?
Yeah, I was at the old Argus Group and then Independent Group collectively for 38 years. So yeah,
right. So you know what you're talking about.
It was rather long time, and I do appreciate that things have changed and the newspaper process is kind of old fashioned and everything's quicker and more pressured now. And of course, the fewer staff, so there's lots of other pressures. But to have a headline like that on a story that, as you say, mentions or quotes, we assume, I mean, we can't have taken on trust, one resident, we don't even know this person's name. And right. And the quote doesn't really explain in any event what he means. Housing, water, everything is not right. That means nothing at all. Did the reporter say, well, what do you mean? Can you please explain yourself? Because our readers need to know. I mean, that was really the old measure. Is if you submitted a story to the news desk and you had something like that in it, the news editor would fling it back at you and say, the readers haven't a clue what you're talking about. What are you talking about? Please explain it. And if you got it wrong, oftentimes I was sent back to a story, but sent back to a source or sent back to you know, maybe 40 miles away to go and redo the interview because the news desk just decided it wasn't good enough. But all these standards, unfortunately, do seem to be slipping. Some media organizations are better than others. You know, it's not universally bad. You did mention that I've tended to be protective to some extent of my old career. And I think there are some very fine journalists out there and people who are trying their best. But a story like this, I think, is just a shocker. It really is just a shocker. It's you know, and one's left wondering what it betrays. Is the media organization anxious about seeming to be on the right side of some or other political spectrum? Is that the reporter's anxiety? Is there some instruction? What exactly is going on here? Because it's very, very puzzling and very worrying. It's very worrying. What on earth are readers to make of this nonsense? It's shoddy.
Yeah, exactly. Sarah, your thoughts. I must say that just before the show, I was mentioning to Michael that I thought that out of all places, the Daily Mail in the UK, which is, of course, kind of tabloidy, quite trashy often, was actually far better at reporting hard news than many other outlets, which is quite funny, I think.
Yeah. I think the problem is that there's an element of political self-righteousness, and too many people in the media at too high a level do take sides. Their analysis is often ill-informed. And too many people want to be analysts and not reporters. And I think the problem is we are short of facts, and the media does bear responsibility for this. I mean, we don't pretend we present facts. I mean, we do present facts, but we research the stuff we write. But we are opinion writers. We are not journalists, and we don't pretend to pretend to be such. It's not that, you know, that the hard questions mustn't be asked of all sides in the political debate.
Exactly.
But it's often the snideness or the overemphasis on something or the complete lack of attention at all to something else. I mean, just the results about how popular Ramaphosa is and how recognized Malema is, but not Steenhuisen. Well, I mean, guys, let's just unpack the fact that Ramaphosa has been around for 27 years and he is the president of the country and has been for the last four. Malema became the media darling from 2014. So John Steenhuisen is the leader of an opposition party that's doing bread and butter stuff. And he's only
the biggest party
for a year during a pandemic. So, you know, you kind of think, well, you know, this is unprofessional.
Yeah,
exactly. And if you wonder why people, I think maybe, and I'll listeners know this far better than I do, but why a lot of people tune in to listen to us rant and rave about everything in the world, it's probably because a lot of them have lost faith in the media, by and large. And it's because of not very good reports like this. This destroys the credibility of the media, and overall, I think it makes people very upset.
Yeah.
So just make a very quick point. You're talking about the Daily Mail in the UK. Probably the closest we've got to that in some respects is The Citizen. If you want an article about something that happened here, there, or anywhere, it's there. It's not, they're not long, they're not complex, they don't delve into anything. But if you want to know factually what is happening at any given time,
who, that's probably how, when, where, why.
The basics.
Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much to my guests for joining me today. And thank you very much to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please support the Institute of Race Relations. Please subscribe. Please like this video. Please leave us good reviews on the podcast apps. I believe that there was a problem yesterday with the hosting website for our podcast. I don't know if that's been fixed. I think we did email them to try and get it sorted. And it's not just affecting us, it seems. But if you're having problems with the audio, it seems like the YouTube version is always working well. So check us out on YouTube if your audio feed's not working. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.